House Judiciary. Today is April 2nd, and it is 7 or 8 minutes after the hour of 1. My guess is we'll be going a little long today. One of the goals today is to get as far through a large stack of amendments on the crime bill SB 64 so we can generate a CS for action and consideration Friday, if possible. We're going to start with a couple of confirmation people that are up for confirmation for gubernatorial appointments, and then we'll be going to HB 375. If you would, call the roll.
Representative Foster. Representative Ledoux.
Present.
Representative Lynn.
Here.
Representative Millett.
Here.
Representative Pruitt. Representative Grunberg. Representative Keller.
Here.
Okay, thank you. Do we have
7268?
Yeah, gotcha. Okay. For starters, we have Mark June. She's wanting to serve on the Commission on Judicial Conduct, and I haven't confirmed that she's online, but I think we will shortly. So
he.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Mark June. Not June Mark. Mark, I see you, you know, you've been here before and done this. If you would, identify yourself and tell us why you're interested in doing this, and see if the committee has any questions for you.
Thank you, Representative Keller. I can assure you that I won't be your first transgender nominee.
I apologize for that. I'm sure, though, that you've had that happen to you before.
Well, and I can assure you that I've had worse happen to me.
Identify yourself, please, and tell us about yourself.
Okay. My name is Mark June, and let me start by telling you a little bit about me. I've been a lawyer in Alaska for 30 years now. During that time, I served in a variety of positions with the Bar Association. I've served on the Board of Governors. I've been a member of the disciplinary panel. I've been a member of the fee arbitration panel. I'm currently on the ethics committee. I also serve on the Alaska Civil Rules Committee. Outside of my professional activities, I'm on the Brother Francis Shelter Advisory Committee. I'm also on the board of directors of Alaska Legal Services. And I can tell you that I have literally appeared in 95% of the courtrooms in this state. This morning I spent out at the Palmer Courthouse on a hearing matter. With respect to the Commission on Judicial Conduct, it's an appointment that's important to me. We have a strong judiciary. I know that at times there's a debate about the selection process, but once judges are selected, the Commission on Judicial Conduct is the mechanism by which we make sure that judges act the way that the canons of judicial conduct require them to act and hold them accountable for not doing so. It's an important body. It has members of the public, members from the bar, and members from the judiciary that make up its make up the body. I look forward to contributing in whatever way I can. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Representative Millett?
So when do you sleep? You are an awfully busy man.
Well, if you talk to my wife, she would tell you that I snore and that she has problems sleeping. But if you ever meet her, please don't bring that up.
Thanks for all your
volunteering. Representative
Ledoux? I just have a comment. I've probably known Mark for 15 to 20 years, and I think he would make an excellent addition to this board.
Thank you for those kind words, Representative Ledoux.
I see no other questions at this time. Representative Grunberg does have a question.
Yeah. Hey, I've known Mr. June for a long time as well. He has the highest reputation, and I got to say he went to a couple of schools that I have more than a passing interest in, Stanford and UCLA Law School, which is where I went, so I'd be remiss if I didn't endorse him. Glad to have you here, Mark. Thanks for your service, as they say.
Thank you, Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you for your willingness to serve. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would move Mark June to be put forward for as a candidate to serve on the Commission on Judicial Conduct and be named forwarded to the full joint session for possible confirmation, and our vote here has no bearing on what happens at the joint session.
Thank you. Seeing no objection, your name will be put forward, and my staff will pass around a signature sheet. As the time goes on, we're not going to stop here now. We'll just go right on to the next one. But I want to say for the record that Representative Foster has joined us and Representative Gruenberg. Right?
Mr. Chair,
here?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, did we do Granger?
We're going to do that on Friday, I think.
I don't see your message.
Now we're out here for Nora Barlow.
Mr. Chair, I didn't see a resume for Granger. Mr. Granger.
Nora, are you online? Violent crimes.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, okay. So if you would, just identify yourself for the record and tell us why you want to serve on the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and thank you for your willingness to do so. That's what makes this state work well.
Thank you. My name's Nora Barlow. I'm an attorney up here in Anchorage. And actually, I've been serving on the Violent Crimes Compensation Board for some time now. This is actually my third confirmation hearing. We're a three-member panel, an attorney, a lay member, and a doctor, and I serve as the attorney member. I'd like to continue doing so because I think it's important work. I enjoy doing it, and it's a means of public service for myself. So. I'll just keep it short and sweet. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
I see one. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, I've known Ms. Barlow for a number of years. She, too, has great qualifications for this, a lot of experience, and I'm pleased to recommend her.
Impressive resume, and I go for it.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Barlow, for testifying here. Mr. Chair, I would move the name of Nora G. Barlow to be put forward as a candidate to serve on the Violent Crimes Compensation Board and to forward her name to the joint session for possible confirmation. And again, how we vote here has no bearing on what might happen in the joint session.
Okay, thank you. See no objection, so we'll put your name forward. And again, the paper will come around on that. So what we'll do now is we'll move into HB 375, and just so you know what the plan is today, we'll go as far as we can go before 2 o'clock, and then at 2 o'clock we'll put other things aside and go back, go to the current crimes bill, and we may go over, you know, but we, again, the intent is to go through as many of the amendments that as we can. So, if you would, identify yourself for the record, sir, and tell us about HB 375. It is not our intention to act on the bill today. It's informational, and we would really like to get, a perspective on what it's about.
Thank you for the record. My name is Darrell Brees, staff representative Bill Stoltz. To the committee, Representative Stoltz apologizes that he cannot be here. He's working on the governor's omnibus education bill right now, and is focusing on trying to get that accomplished as we wrap up session here today. HB 375 is a rather simple but yet complex piece of legislation. What it does is it repeals two sections of the criminal trespass statutes in the definition section, eliminating the specific notice that's included in there to give notice of trespass in a specific manner. Some may ask why this legislation is being brought forward. In the Madawaska Valley this past year, there were two instances where trespass was, in some people's minds, obviously occurred, but could not be enforced because of the specific definitions that were contained in statute. In August, a constituent of Representative Stoltz, John Venduska, had his tame pet turkey Buddy shot and killed in his driveway by some bow hunters because he did not have signs clearly posted. There was nothing that could be done to enforce them. Later in November, Nicole Jordan, on a business, a gravel pit that she operates next to Colony Middle School. Had some individuals who were trapping on the property without permission, but because there was no signs posted that said this is prohibited and there's no trespassing allowed in the manner described in statute, the trappers were basically allowed to trespass there, and was determined later that no laws were broken by them setting the traps there, even though they did not have the permission from the property owner or from Ms. Jordan and her business, which leased the property. One thing that Representative Stoltz wants to make clear to the committee, this isn't about hunting or trapping. This is about clearly defining a property owner's rights to declare what can happen and cannot happen on their property. The repeal takes away the definitions, and if you'd like, I take you through the section. It's really simple. It's two repeals. The first section deals with definitions. They both deal with definitions. Statute book here so I can walk you through them. AS 1146-350 section B basically says, for this section, a person who without intent to commit a crime on land enters or remains upon unimproved and apparently unused land which is neither fenced nor otherwise enclosed in a manner designed to exclude intruders is privileged to do so unless a notice of trespass is personally communicated to that person by the owner of the land or some other authorized person, or notice against trespass is given by posting in a reasonably conspicuous manner under the circumstances. Section C, the second section of statute being repealed, a notice against trespass is given if the notice is printed legibly in English, is at least 144 square inches in size, and contains the name, address, and person under whose authority the property is posted, and the name and address of the person who is authorized to grant permission to enter the property. Number five, is placed at each roadway and at each way of access onto the property that is known to the landowner. Number five, in a case of an island, is placed along the perimeter at each cardinal point of the island. And number six, finally, states any specific prohibition that the posting is directed against, such as no trespassing, no hunting, no fishing, no digging, or similar prohibitions. In the cases that happened in the Madawaska Valley this summer, in Representative Stoltz's district and in the adjoining district, the individuals who owned the property, the one property where the people were trapping had a sign that said no trespassing. It wasn't a large enough sign, and it wasn't clearly posted on each point of access. So it was determined that the individuals who were trapping on the property weren't in violation of the law. That's a summary of the bill and summary of why we brought the bill forward. I'm here to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Ledoux.
Here, I thought you mentioned that if the owner gives them specific notice, that that becomes trespassing. So you had that case where they were doing the trapping on the land, and I had gathered from the newspaper article that the owner said, hey, you shouldn't be here, you know, get off my property. So how come they didn't prosecute?
Because the law states that because the signs weren't posted in the clear and concise manner.
But once they were told, didn't they have to? I mean, I thought that what you had read, and I don't have what you read right in front of me. I thought it said if you tell the person personally, that makes it trespassing. Am I incorrect?
In my interpretation, you are correct. It was determined in the courts that was not the case because the signs were not clearly posted. Maybe a question better directed to Ms. Carpenter. Yes, she's here. She could probably address it from the Department of Law's perspective as far as how the law applies.
And what about the follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
And the turkey, which seemed like, I mean, it had a name, so, I mean, an animal that has a name to me is a pet. So how come there wasn't any prosecution when you're killing somebody's pet?
That'd have to be, again, a question for the Department of Law, why they didn't proceed in that case. My understanding, I don't believe the owner wanted to proceed beyond the fact that he was disappointed that someone was allowed to come on his property and take such severe action.
And one more thing.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair.
So, I mean, this sounds like a great bill, but here's what I'm concerned about. So, I mean, I do a lot of hiking. And so you're just hiking through something, and if you don't see that something has a sign up that it's no trespassing, I mean, you'd conceivably be guilty of a misdemeanor just by for crossing somebody's land like that, where you're not going to be doing any hunting or trapping or killing their pet turkeys or anything like that. You've just started out on the day and you're going for a hike.
Through the chair to Representative Ledoux, Commissioner Red Fogles here can speak to the fact that there is an easement that exists across lands where there are historic trails and things of that nature. So the trails and hiking that's allowed across lands in rural areas. These two incidents that occurred were not you know, the one on Lazy Mountain where the turkey was killed is a rural area at the top of the mountain, but it's just outside of Palmer. It's not like you're out in the middle of the wilderness where there's a lot of hiking that goes on. And it was clearly in someone's driveway where it took place. Easement across lands, and Mr. Fogles could probably speak to it more clearly than I could, is allowed if you're crossing an existing easements and existing trails. That's still allowed and is not trespass if the trail existed. If you're blazing a trail against someone's property that doesn't exist before, there is an opportunity that, yes, you could be cited for trespass, and I'm guessing you'll probably need the individual whose property it is to bring that case forward.
Thank you.
This bill repeals the two sections of the definitions and basically places the burden on the person who wants to access the land to get permission to be there, as opposed to the property owner basically opening without if they don't post signs currently, they basically say anyone who wants to have access to my property has access to my property. Unless you post specifically as described in statute currently. This bill makes it so the person has to seek out, if you're going to be hiking, if you're going to be trapping, maps are available either through municipalities, boroughs, or cities, USGS, BLM, to find out who property owners are. It gets more difficult as you get into more rural areas of Alaska as to who ownership is and where ownership exists and takes place. But that's becoming more and more available, and I think as we move forward, we need to look out and protect the personal property rights and put the burden on those who want to access people's land to acquire the permission before, rather than just opening it up for anyone and everyone who wants to access someone's land.
You have a question, Representative Foster?
I guess maybe just a comment, and that is that I've got the same concern, I think, as Representative Ledoux. I do a lot of hiking as well, and I understand the need to protect the private landowner, especially if there's going to be something like, you know, killing of pets and so forth. But, you know, I wish that there's some way to find some middle ground on this one, because I certainly, if I'm going to go for a hike, sometimes I just don't even know where I'm going to hike. I just go to a point and then I just start walking. And so I think it would be, you know, difficult to, I just don't see most people going out getting maps and so forth to look. But again, it gets back to if you're walking on somebody's property, that's their property, and if they don't want you there, I understand that too. So I'm in a little bit of a conundrum on that one. So,
Representative Grunberg?
I have many of the same concerns. Although I've got to say my hiking consists of going from the refrigerator to the TV couch.
Wow.
You don't walk upstairs?
Never.
Representative Duke?
Kidding.
Well, it's probably a little bit far-fetched, but I guess I'm just sort of wondering that under this bill, let's say you're going down a street and you realize that you've got to turn, and so you turn in somebody's driveway, and the driveway, of course, doesn't have a no trespassing sign on it, and so you're turning around in the driveway, and I think people probably do that all the time. I mean, I know I do it all the time. I mean, would that make me into a misdemeanor criminal?
Through the chair to Representative Ledoux, the statutes not included in this repeal that define first degree and second degree trespass clearly state that a person who enters or remains unlawfully. So I think if you're just turning around in someone's driveway, I don't think you'll run the risk of being prosecuted as long as you're not remaining there. I think the remaining there and staying there for long periods of time, I think that would probably apply also possibly to hiking if you're just walking across. An area where you'd be hiking, which is typically going to be wilderness. I think most landowners would understand if they see you out there and don't want you there, they would say, hey, can you please stay off my property in the future? And I don't see a large number of cases being filed just because this repeal is taking place. I think where the enforcement issues are going to come up on this are going to be in areas, in more urban areas and places where people clearly don't want people accessing their properties and conducting activities such as trapping and hunting and things like that without first giving permission to an individual.
Okay. Thank you for your it's a tall order, and you can see why we didn't want to move the bill today, because, I mean, my word, it's a big issue when you're talking, when you think about all the different kinds of land we have in Alaska, private land, public land, federal land, state land, you know, and there's a big difference between a lot and property that's maybe owned by one of the native corporations. You know, you got a lot of questions here on this one that we have to look at. So if we would, let's take our testimony now, and we'll let this one simmer in our brains a little bit. Nicole Jordan from Palmer.
Yes.
If you would, state your name and who you are speaking for, and give us your testimony.
My name is Nicolene Jordan. I'm the leasor of the property of the trappers. We filed a civil suit against those trappers. They gave us an offer of judgment of $250. It cost me quite a bit of money to just bring this forward to begin with. So I want to say that the people that did this, that it was the second year that they trapped here. And they went to an access point that was blocked with logs and rocks. So it was obvious it was clearly marked that we didn't want anybody to go in there, but they did anyway. And they brought moose carcasses as bait to trap with, which is neither here nor there, except for one of the trappers was an Alaska's wildlife trooper. So he should have known better to begin with. And that's why we need to rewrite this law, because if the troopers can't understand it, then obviously the general public is having a hard time with it too. And also, I went to the borough just to see how long it would take me to find out whose property was where in the valley. And from the moment I parked the car in the parking lot of the borough building and walked inside and found what I needed to know, it took me exactly 4 minutes. So, and that was physically doing it, but on a cell phone or any other electronic device, you can figure out whose property it is within minutes. I mean, you don't have to gather maps. And if it's clearly, you know, we had no trespassing signs around the property, but this is 160 acres. Our biggest concern here is keeping the four-wheelers and the dirt bikes out so that they don't, you know, we don't come to work some morning and find out that somebody's dead at the bottom of one of our gravel banks. So the trapping thing was a big surprise. And it's not that hard to figure out whose property it is anymore, not with, you know, electronics so readily available. But I really want to thank Representative Stoltz for bringing this to the attention of the legislature. And I just want to again say how important it is to protect our rights as property owners. And it really shouldn't be the burden of the property owner to prosecute these guys. Something should be a little bit more clear so that we can enjoy our own property without stumbling across moose carcasses and just, you know, whoever else wants to be on your property. And I don't think it's anybody's right to be on anybody's personal property unless you're dying. For instance, if you're out in the woods and you're dying and you need to use somebody's cabin to stay alive, then that's okay, but, you know, the person that does that is still liable for any damages that they cause. So it's not a big issue. It's just a little bit of changing of the wording, and that would help property owners immensely. And I guess that's pretty much all I have to say at this point.
Thank you, Nicole. I see no questions at this point, so we'll move on to John Vandusky.
Am I there?
Yes, you're. We hear you. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record and tell us your testimony.
Well, this is John Venduska, and I live in Palmer. I'm the one with the that had the turkey shot at the end of my driveway. And I think this is a good bill, too. And the reason why, I could give a little recap of the story. Maybe some of you read it in the paper. I've lived in this place for 40 years and have always had chickens, free-range chickens, running around my property because I live outside of town and they really don't cause any trouble with anybody. But 4 years ago, I got these four turkey eggs and I incubated them. And I couldn't eat them because they were real friendly and they're kind of heritage breeds that can fly and walk around, and they'd follow me around like a dog and everything, and they lived here perfectly okay for 4 years, and the neighbors really, they kind of became kind of little members of the community here. And what happened is all of a sudden, you know, one of them turned up missing, and then another one turned up missing, and I went around looking for them because nothing ever happened to them in 4 years, and I found this bloody arrow. And then I thought, oh, someone must be shooting them, you know. And then one day I was home, and the neighbor came in and says, hey, I think someone just shot one of your turkeys. And I said, what, you know? And he says, yeah, there was a car parked at the end of your driveway, and there was three kids going towards your coop where you keep your chickens and stuff there with bows. And I yelled at them what they were, you know, asked them what they were doing, and they said they saw a spike bull back there, and the neighbor said that, well, John don't want you hunting on his place there. And they said, oh, okay. And when they left, he noticed that there was blood on their bumper, and so he pulled right in the driveway to tell me this. And I said, when this happened, you know? And they said, just now. And so I said, where'd they go? And they said they just drove up the subdivision road. So I ran to the end of the driveway, and sure enough, there's a big puddle of blood there, and it's a dead end, the subdivision road, so they had to come back, and I waited for them, and when they came back, I flagged them down, and I said, did you just shoot a turkey at the end of the driveway? And they said, oh, yeah, like we told your neighbor, we were after a spike bull, but this wild turkey came by, and we shot it. And I said, there ain't no wild turkeys in Alaska. And I said, you know, there's been several others. These are my pets, and, you know, and they thought it was perfectly okay, and I said, I'm going to call the troopers on you guys. So that's when the troopers came up, and the trooper told me, well, you don't have your driveway posted with a no hunting sign there. And I said, well, I didn't think I needed to have a no hunting. That looks kind of rude if you have a no hunting sign in your driveway. And I said, well, you could see one. I do own 120 acres. When I first came up here 40 years ago, I only had enough money to buy 2.5 acres right where my house is. But since then, I bought a 120-acre piece, and I have the same problems that Nikki Jordan has, his four-wheelers coming in there. So I have the property pretty well posted, and you could see a sign just 100 feet down the road, but it wasn't properly placed on my driveway, and it wasn't the size that they need and all that. And he says, no, he says, this is, you know, wrong what these kids did. But these turkeys are not a native game animal, and you didn't have your land posted. So, you know, even though it was wrong, there's nothing, they didn't commit no crime. And I said, you got to be kidding. What if my dog was, I don't have a dog, but what if a dog or cat or horse or cow, they're not native animals. What if they were out there? Well, a chicken or a turkey doesn't meet the value of a, you know, like a dog or cat or cow or horse or something like that. So he virtually said, you know, actually, he kind of put the blame on me for not keeping them locked up, but I've had it like this for years and years and never a problem until this happened. So, but I did want to make a comment on some of the representatives' statements about why they have concerns about this is if they were, you know, they're hikers and stuff like that. I think the intent of this change in the legislation isn't, if you're hiking on someone's private property and the person catches you and says, no, this is private property, I need you to get off, I would say 99% of reasonable people are going to just say, no, I don't want you on my property, kick you off. They're not going to prosecute you. And if they did, you know, it would be some unreasonable landowner that would do that, that would get nowhere. I think the intent of this law is to stop things that are happening to me and Nikki and people like that, where they come onto your property and actually cause trouble or crime like these people did.
Thank you, John. Representative Ledoux has a question.
I just want to make clear that I really want to ask Ms. Carpinetti or somebody from the Department of Law why a circumstance like this, where basically he killed the pet, why that wouldn't be prosecuted by the troopers, why somebody can go on somebody's land under the law as it is now and kill one of your pets and that's not a crime?
If we could, we call Annie on the spot all the time. Is it okay if I ask Quinlan for a response on that one? Quinlan's online to answer a question, as is Burke Waldron from the Department of Public Safety. Quinlan, have you heard the question?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
I'll let Representative Ledoux repeat the question. I probably would like to add to it, but go ahead.
Well, the gentleman testifying had a pet turkey, which was right around his house, and some kids came on his property and shot the pet turkey with an arrow, I think. And the troopers said that it wasn't trespassing because the property, the driveway, was not posted, and I guess I'm trying to figure out why just the act of killing somebody's pet, be it a dog or a cat or a turkey, wouldn't be a prosecutable offense.
This is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. I didn't research that particular issue, but I'm not sure why it wouldn't be either. If you entered unlawfully with the intent to commit a crime or committed a crime on somebody's land, and I can only assume that shooting somebody's pet would be, though I didn't look that up specifically, but that would be the question with criminal trespass. If you entered, and at the time you entered, you had the intent to shoot that animal, then I believe you would be guilty of criminal trespass.
Follow up? Even if it's not criminal trespass, even if it's perfectly okay to go on the land. I mean, you could invite somebody onto your property, but then if they take out a bow and arrow and shoot your pet, it may not be trespass, but it's got to be something else.
I would assume at the very least it would be criminal mischief if you assume that a pet is somebody's property and it has value.
Thank you for your responses. We appreciate it. We'll be looking at this. Burke Waldron is on questions also. I'd like to ask you, Burke, if you would identify yourself for the record when you respond, but do you think the trooper made the right call there, or statement to the landowner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Captain Burke Waldron with the Alaska Wildlife Troopers. I am calling in from Palmer. In regards to the turkey question, I don't feel comfortable answering that question until I do more research and get some more information before I'd feel more comfortable to answer that. I'd be happy to do that and get back to the committee at a later date with that information.
Captain Waldron, that'd be great if you would just address it to the office. And that puts you in the same spot as the committee as we're figuring out the details on this. So thank you. With that, we're going to put HB 375 aside for now. And in the pile of bills here, we'll do the best we can to get back to it. But what we're going to do now is move on to Senate Bill 171. And we have
64.
Nikolai.
What bill are we going to?
Senate Bill 171. And if you would identify yourself for the record and present the bill, and I have no preconceived intentions on this, so the committee, if you get the urge to move, I'd be delighted. And if there's questions, we'll see what happens. So if you would, identify yourself for the record and go for it.
For the record, Reneva Moss, staff for Senator Coghill. And, Mr. Chairman, I do have a CS that I presented to the committee to be adopted.
Vice Chair Lynn, would you move the CS for to be adopted for discussion?
I'd be happy to do so. Mr. Chair, I would move House CS for CS for Senate Bill number 171, that would be 28-LS1416 /P for discussion.
Seeing no objection, that's the version in front of us. So we are on the record clean.
First of all, I'll tell you how we got to this point. The Alaska Children's Justice Act Task Force had a lunch and learn here about 6 weeks ago and presented some issues that are facing agencies that deal with child abuse and sexual abuse. And one of those was that we, as you know, have multidisciplinary child protection teams that work together. They were created several years ago to prevent children who are victims of child abuse or sexual abuse from being interviewed multiple times by different agencies that are involved in these investigations. So under the current statute, it is perceived by all these agencies that Office of Children's Services is the only one who can establish one of these MDTs. This legislation expands that so that any state or municipal agency of law enforcement or a tribe can establish a multidisciplinary child protection team. That is the biggest part of this bill. The other thing we did is we looked at the composition of MDTs, and we added a couple people, which includes someone from someone who's versed in ICWA, who's designated by a tribe that might be involved in the case. We've also added someone from juvenile justice and a medical provider who has received training in child abuse assessment. Then what we did is we found that MDTs sometimes don't meet often enough to keep abreast of what's happening with this child, so we've put a mandate that they meet monthly. There doesn't have to be a quorum. There's no votes. It's by consensus. And one of the ideal things about MDTs is that instead of having one social worker making all the calls on this child's events in life, you have all these experts that sit and discuss it and come to a compromise on it. I think that pretty much covers the bill, Mr. Chairman. We feel like it's going to make sure that a child who is not involved in an OCS case but has been a victim of child abuse or sexual abuse will get the same treatment that a child gets when they're going through the process with OCS.
Any questions for the sponsor? In the the team itself, is there any existing members or expansion to include community people or people at significant others of the child, or is it not?
Chairman, that would be a mediation. When you have a mediation, you have family members, friends, teachers, nurses. It's a different process.
Okay, I understand. Any other questions for the sponsor? Seeing no questions and seeing nobody here to testify, anybody in the room want to testify? Okay, so we'll close public testimony and before the committee for discussion or action.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Millett.
I really like this bill. I think it's a very well-written bill and well thought out bill. So if it would pleasure the committee, I would like to move CS for Senate Bill 171 Judiciary 28-LS14160, is that the right version? P? I'm trying to make sure I have
it's P, yes.
P, sorry, okay, yes, P, from committee with individual recommendations, and it looks like zero fiscal notes.
And I'm going to object just because we want to hold here just a little bit. We got Jessica Lawmaster. I'll open public testimony again. Jessica Lawmaster from Palmer, Alaska, Alaska Children's Alliance. Did you want to comment on SB 171? Did you, if you hold on a little bit, Jessica. Representative Grunberg, did you have a question?
Yeah, I've searched my file twice. I see an O version, but I don't see a P. Oh.
Okay. That's the one we adopted right at the beginning.
Right, and I just was looking for it. And
okay, back on line, Jessica, if you would identify yourself and give us your testimony.
This is Jessica Lawmaster. I'm the executive director of Haven House, which is a domestic violence sexual assault resource center in Homer, and we administer three child advocacy centers across the Kenai Peninsula. I'm also the chair of the Alaska Children's Alliance, which represents all of the child advocacy centers in the state. And I'll keep it brief. I just wanted to call in today and express my support for this bill on behalf of all of the child advocacy centers and the Children's Alliance in the state, and just wanted to be available in case there were any questions from a direct service perspective. But I will just leave it at that unless there are questions. Thank you.
Jessica, there's a question for you. Representative Millett?
Well, I have an unrelated question, but I hope you'll give me some latitude here. Have you had an opportunity to look at Aaron's Law bill?
Yes, I actually testified about that this morning.
Oh, okay, good. Okay. And I'm assuming you're in favor of that? This just seems like a really good, these two are complementary bills, and that's why I brought it up, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely.
I think that they're very, very complementary to get this in order when Aaron's Law does come on.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for Jessica for taking the time to call in. I'm going to remove my objection. Is there any further objection? I'll put my objection back on for Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see we have here under the membership of the team, we have a prosecutor, and this is number six, B6 on page 2, lines 22 and 23. And then we have an attorney who specializes in child protection in the Attorney General's office. And Mr. Chair, I need to ask Ms. Moss, or do we, I'll start out with Ms. Moss, through the chair, if I can. As a family law, with the chair's permission, as a family law practitioner for many, many years, and having done some of these cases, it's my understanding that the person who takes the civil cases is a member of the Attorney General's staff, is an assistant attorney general. I assume what you're talking about here on lines 22 and 23 is a criminal prosecutor. So they both are in the Department of Law, but one is civil and the other is criminal. Through the chair, Ms. Ross, is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I gave you my copy of the bill, so I can't see.
Oh, here. Can you give it to you back? This is a quick regroup. Thanks, Renee. I'll give you a moment to catch where I was on the bill.
You would think while we're waiting here to catch up that we had a shortage of bills around here, but the truth of the matter is they're all over. We just can't find them at the right time. If you would, Reneva, identify yourself for the record after the break here and go for it.
For the record, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I believe what you have here is you have the first team, subsection B, is what an MDT will be. The second section is by consensus, invited people. So a prosecutor could be a tribal court. It doesn't necessarily have to be through the state court.
May I continue, please?
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Okay. I'm beginning to see here. But we're talking in the word prosecutor of a criminal prosecutor, regardless of whether they work in a tribal jurisdiction or in a state court, through the chair. Is that correct?
Could you repeat that?
Yeah. Regardless of whether they work for a tribal court system mm-hmm. or they work for the state courts, I mean, in the state court, it's a person who prosecutes criminally.
Yes.
Okay. The thing that I'm concerned about is that there is nobody here who would represent potentially the defense on here. I don't see anybody either from the public defender or OPA or a private bar or anything, and I'm a little bit concerned if this is a child protection team and they're developing procedures and stuff that they don't have both sides represented. Am I missing something, or is there a defense attorney in there somewhere?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we do have someone here from Department of Law, but my guess is because the MDTs are focused on healing the child, this team is not really concerned with the prosecution of a defendant. It's concerned with getting this child's life and the family's life back in order, getting them the counseling that they need. I think it's completely separate from the criminal process.
I'm going to add, or Representative Millett and then Representative Ledoux.
Well, on that point, I just don't understand why you would want anybody that had caused harm to the child to have any representation on this. You're trying to heal the child, not
right.
prosecute. I mean, there's no place. I mean,
this is a bill
that would be inflicting more wound onto more wound. I mean, this is to get the child healthy again. So I think the makeup of it is absolutely perfect. I mean, this is after the fact. This is something that happened after the fact. The trauma happened after the fact.
Representative Ledoux?
Well, I guess on that point also, even if it were an investigative team looking into prosecution, since when does a defense counsel sit at the prosecutor's table and help them develop strategy?
Right.
Okay, so we got that question answered.
No longer be. I stand corrected.
Women helped you today.
And for the record, they both took the words right out of my mouth.
And I agree.
I'm going to close public testimony again and remove my objection. Is there any further objection? Okay, SB 171 passes from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With,
now the fun's
going to
begin, Max.
I'll get a cup of
coffee. Yeah, okay. We'll take it at ease.
You and I.
Actually, on to SB 64. That's working out pretty well. We just, again, to restate what we're trying to do today, we have quite a stack of amendments to go through. And we want to act on all of the amendments that we can possibly act on, and then we'll do a CS, and we'll come back to this again on Friday, and we'll, if the committee would be prepared again on Friday to stay a little longer, if it stretches on and we don't get our work done, it would be very much appreciated. We'll do it at 2 o'clock again. I'm sorry. Okay. Well.
So.
If Representative Ledoux, you had a question
so
on the
we're
process.
We're going to be taking some public testimony today?
Not today.
Be patient.
Oh, okay.
Be patient. I was telling you the plan here that we're going through. We have several, we'll open public testimony back up, and we have several that Representative Ledoux requested that we give them an option to testify because they hadn't had the option. And then we'll close public testimony and get into the amendments. So, is it Babette Miller?
Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah, now we have you loud and clear. Take a little brief at ease. Just stand by a little bit, Babette. Back on the record, we are not taking testimony at this time on amendments. Okay, what we're doing is taking testimony on the bill. And what I intend to do, because this is a difficult amendment that has to do with the ignition lock and the 24/7 and how they fit together and who's afraid of losing something or whatever. I don't know, understand the issue. I have to learn it myself. The reason for that is we're moving that amendment to the bottom of the pile.
Good.
We'll get as far as we can with it today in the discussion, but I want to get to the amendments that are not going to take up the rest of the day first. So I really apologize if you didn't understand that.
I guess I did, and I'm wondering whether the people who want to testify, though, will be able to testify before the amendment relating to the interlock is adopted.
Well, we can take that into consideration. I hadn't made up my mind on that one, but, the intent is.
Representative
Ledoux, we're on the record. When we have the CS adopted, okay, with or without this information in, that's the time we'll have testimony then on the CS. Okay, so that's the plan.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, we're going to go back to Babette, who has patiently stood by. And, again, do you have testimony on the bill, on SB 64? And if you do not, if your testimony was specifically addressed at the amendment, which the committee is just dealing with now, you'll get opportunity to testify on that when we get to the CS stage of the bill, which may or may not include the amendment, depending on what the committee decides. So did you have testimony on the bill, SB 64, Babette?
Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, if you would. Identify yourself. And
my name is Babette Miller, and I'm with Smart Start of Alaska. What I was calling in regards to was the in-home breathalyzer test and the ignition interlock. So if you would prefer that I testify when the amendment is adopted or considered, I can do it at that time if you'd like.
Okay. Stand by, if you would, just a little bit, Babette. We're going to take another at ease. I want to talk to you.
We took
Thank you for your patience. Babette, as I understand it, and this is what I had to clarify with my staff, is that right now, under existing law, you can get a temporary license with ignition lock. And what we're contemplating is potentially amending it so there's another option there. So I think that you can go ahead and testify on your ignition lock information right now, because it's based on existing law, and it will give us it'll prepare us when we get to the point of hearing this testimony. You've taken time to out of your day to call, so we don't want to cut you short. So go right ahead, and if you would, about five, no more than 5 minutes, please. But go ahead,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruber.
A parliamentary request.
Mm-hmm.
Since we have, in some cases,
Mr. Chairman,
Hold on a little bit again, Babette. You got interrupted by a improper action of the chair. I acknowledge somebody else right on top of you. So if you would stand by just a little bit, Representative Grunberg.
It would help me, if Ernest or somebody, if there's a particular amendment this relates to tell us so we can have that amendment in front of us. That
Representative Grunberg, you have the amendment in front of you. It's
so
L2.
Many. Everybody's on the same.
It's number L2 that's in front of you, and it's the one we're going to put to the bottom of the pile, and we're not going to address it till later. Right now, we're taking testimony on SB 64. But Beth, I think that's the third time I interrupted you. So this time, I will let you speak. Identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you very much. So what I'm calling in regards to is the amendment that would allow an individual to get a limited license having the option to obtain an in-home breathalyzer versus the ignition interlock device. Although I believe that the in-home breathalyzers are a great addition to a person when they are violating the ignition interlock device, I do not believe that the in-home breathalyzers have the capability of preventing an individual from drinking and driving. At this time, the ignition interlock violations are not used as an enhancement to prevent the person from continuing to drink. The ignition interlocks are there to prevent an individual from drinking and driving. The in-home breathalyzer proposal that I seen was for a person to be able to choose, you know, whether they have an in-home breathalyzer or an ignition interlock device. The ignition interlock device prevents the vehicle from starting. The in-home breathalyzer does not. So I believe that it is a great addition to our toolbox, but I don't believe that it should be considered as a replacement to preventing a vehicle from starting.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, and we will definitely keep that in mind as we press on. Quinlan Steiner, you're online. First of all, is there any questions? I don't see any questions this time. Quinlan Steiner, I see you're on to testify on this, on SB 64.
Yes,
and if I remember right, we asked, you called in one time before, and we were short on time, and you graciously waited to testify later, and so I think this is it.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. And I wanted to comment briefly on the property crime levels and raising the thresholds that distinguish felonies from misdemeanors. One of the benefits of raising these levels, you know, they haven't been raised since 1978 when they were established. And as a result, what conduct is a misdemeanor, what conduct is a felony, has changed just through inflation over the years. More and more crimes are being punished as felonies. And because this has changed so dramatically over the years, I think what's resulted is a disparity in how these are prosecuted across the state. Some areas, they're prosecuted right at $500, and others, when they're up over $1,000, may be reduced just as a general policy by the state. But it's not consistent across the state, not consistent among prosecutors and jurisdictions. One of the things that raising the level will do is reduce that disparity. When the levels are much higher and they're more appropriately considered felony amounts, and just in terms of their impact, they'll be treated more evenly across the state, is my expectation. This will also have the benefit of reducing the cost for prosecution of these kind of lower level property crimes. Misdemeanors are much less expensive to process. My expectation would also be that it would actually promote restitution to the individuals who have been harmed or suffered a loss through this. When offenses are prosecuted as a misdemeanor versus a felony, misdemeanors don't have the kind of impact on somebody's ability to get work in the future in the way that felonies do. Felonies can often preclude people from getting interviews or jobs or employment in a way that misdemeanors just don't have that impact. So really actually treating them as misdemeanors is more likely to promote restitution. And I think that goes for treatment as well. The lower level prosecutions as misdemeanors, you know, there isn't a significant likelihood that they'll be taken out of the system so long that they won't be able to immediately get treatment for the issues that maybe have presented that conduct. You can get referrals under misdemeanors to get an assessment for treatment and to engage in treatment right away. And that would ultimately promote both restitution and rehabilitation of the individual who's been charged. And I know that some concerns have been raised about people engaged in this sort of as a scheme to make money over long periods of time. I just note that there's still a habitual offender section to the statute, so, you know, multiple incidences can become a felony, you know, when you're in that lower level amount. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know there's been some discussion about taking testimony later on amendments. I do have some concern about one of the amendments raised, and I'd be happy to talk about that now or wait until the amendment's brought before the committee, but it relates to unlawful evasion.
I'm thinking.
Mr. Chair.
Quinlan, what I think we're going to do on that is stay with the standard we've set, and that is that we're going to let the committee act. That does not mean that you will not be able to testify on that question. That amendment is not in front of us, and the committee will act on it, but then the CS will be up, and you will be able to testify on the CS, if that amendment passes and becomes part of the bill. So sorry to drag you out on that, but I think that that's the approach we're going to continue to take.
Well, I'm happy to answer any questions. Then.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Chair, my comment a moment ago was somewhat along the same line, because we are going to have an amendment here on the level, and you don't want any questions on his recommendation on this at the moment.
That's what I just said, right? Thank you. Okay. I don't see any other questions, Quinlan. Thank you. So I'm going to close public testimony for now, and we'll see how we can do with the going through the list. We're just trying to get it. Or I forgot one. Public testimony's back open. I don't have you on my list, so you're in front of me. But I acknowledged you. Jeff Jesse, if you would. Identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony on SB 64, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And I'm very pleased to testify in favor of this bill. This bill is not only extremely timely, but it's very strategic. There's a lot going on right now around criminal justice and recidivism and our growing prison population. Not only is the Criminal Justice Working Group and the Reentry Task Force working diligently on these issues, but as some of you know, the House Finance Committee has included intent language in the budget directing the court system, the Department of Corrections, Department of Labor, Health and Social Services, AHFC, and the Mental Health Trust to develop a plan to reduce recidivism and avoid building another prison. This bill is very important first step to moving that process ahead, raising the felony threshold, creating the Criminal Justice Commission, the Recidivism Fund, 24/7 sobriety, all are very important first steps. What I would urge the committee is to be, as I know you will be, very judicious in consideration of amendments. We're at that stage of the game now in the second legislative session where a bill looks like it's going to get somewhere and it suddenly attracts all kinds of good ideas. I've been working with Representative Gruenberg's office on a very good idea. But we have decided not to try to get it into this bill because this bill needs to pass. So I just encourage you to be judicious in making it better. We're going to have lots of time in coming sessions to improve our criminal justice system. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff. I really thank you for that testimony. I couldn't have said it better myself. we want to bolt together a good bill here consistent with the intent that it was started with, and we'll try to do that, and we'll take your advice seriously. So now we're going to close public testimony. And that brings us then to Amendment L.2. It's 28LS0116L.2, and we're going to set that aside. That's an amendment that I'll be offering, and the reason I'm saying this again is that when we bring this back up, presumably it will be Friday. That'll give time for some of the misinformation, I think, that I, at least from my perspective, that's gone out there to be dealt with, and I will be offering this amendment on Friday, and then at that time I will ask because it's my amendment, I'm going to ask that my staff, Ernest, and Senator Coghill's staff, Jordan, be prepared to go through the amendment and give us an idea of what it does. But I'm going to try to avoid on that during that amendment process, again, getting into a lot of public testimony and calling the experts. So the reason I'm saying that is call your experts now. So that when we have this decision in front of us on Friday, it's a clean decision and we can press on. So that brings us to the next on the list, and it's LS0116L.4 by Representative Millett.
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment L.4. It's also offered by Millett, Pruitt, and Keller. This, anybody going to object? Or
we'll call that Amendment number 1.
Okay.
And is there an objection?
Yes, for discussion.
Okay. Representative Millett?
This would make theft in the second degree the value of the possession of the stolen property $750, delete $1,200, and insert $750 in all those pages, so the threshold would be lowered to $750. I believe that the $1,200 threshold is much too high, and I believe that we need to make sure that our small business and our small business owners who $750 is a lot of money. $1,200 is a lot more money. So I prefer if we go from $500 to $750. So we'd strike everything that says $1,200, and the amount for theft in the second degree would be $750. That's the gist of my amendment.
Any comments or discussion, Representative Grunberg?
Yes, but I'd like to add my name to the sponsorship of this.
And Representative Grunberg is also on the amendment.
Oh.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I also would like to add my name. You know, quite frankly, I'd just sooner stay at 500, but 750 is a good compromise.
And Representative Lynn's name is added to the amendment.
I beg your pardon?
And I'm adding your name to the amendment. Foster?
Do you maintain your objection?
Oh, no.
Ledoux, you want in on this?
I mean, when everybody, Wes, when everybody's finished.
I'm just asking before. So that's the amendment, Mr. Chair.
I see no other comments. Do you maintain your objection, sir? Representative Ledoux, I'm sorry.
I kind of feel uncomfortable reducing it to 750, but I can read the tea leaves here, so.
by just the sponsors of the amendment? You're a smart woman.
I'll remove my objection. If
okay. See no other objection. Amendment number 1 passes. May all the rest of them be that easy.
If they were all mine, they would be.
I have in front of me LS0116L.5, Gardner, upper right-hand corner. Representative Grunberg?
Okay.
Can I make it easier, Representative Grunberg? How about if I suggest that you tell us a little bit what the amendment is without moving the amendment, just very briefly, and we will move this one also to the bottom of the pile.
Could I ask my staff to carry it, please?
Yeah, that's probably appropriate. It's one of those things that Jeff Jesse just warned us about, you know, of being judicious in getting this thing through, but it's a...
So we're not moving the amendment?
We're not moving this amendment. We're just going to talk about it for a little bit, and then we're going to move it to the bottom of the pile, just like I talked about L2. Do I follow my own rules, Representative Millett?
Well, procedurally, Mr. Chair, you should adopt it and then object, and we can move it to the bottom of the pile with the objection. But to talk about an amendment before we've moved the amendment.
That sounds better.
Thank you.
Let's do that.
So if someone moves it, I will object.
Discussion only, I move the amendment.
And I'll object for discussion only.
Christine, did you get that? Because he wasn't near the mic. We run a loose ship around here for such a tight bill.
No, actually, you're running a tight ship by doing it right.
Okay, Representative Millett objected to the movement forward discussion of L.5. And in that context, very briefly, come up and describe what the amendment would do if the committee so moves.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ted Madsen, staff to Representative Max Gruenberg. Amendment L.5 has to do with the Social Impact Financing Mechanism Study. And what I mean by Social Impact Financing Mechanism is that it's a way to bring market forces to bear on public sector problems through an innovative policy instrument that was developed a couple of years ago through a group called Social Finance UK and the Rockefeller Foundation in the United Kingdom. In essence, what it does is it invites private sector capital, whether it's from an investment banking institution, whether it's from private sector investors, institutional investors. It takes that money, and that money goes to buy a contract. The proceeds of the sale of that contract, the government agency puts out that contract. The proceeds of the sale from that contract go to fund a suite of nonprofit programs that are all marching towards the same goal. In this case, it would be reducing recidivism. If the goals of those nonprofits are met, say reducing recidivism by 10% amongst the target population, then the investor gets paid their money back, plus an agreed-upon interest rate at the end of an agreed-upon time horizon. And those outcomes are evaluated by an independent evaluator that is independent of the three previous entities that I've talked about: the investor, the nonprofit program, and the government agency. A wholly neutral evaluator to decide if outcomes have been achieved. This amendment before you is not setting up a social impact financing mechanism. That would be a very, very large policy call to just try to create in this one simple amendment. The amendment itself looks for the pieces of the puzzle, and it comes back and it directs the Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees to come back with the pieces of the puzzle for presentation to the legislature and say, these are the components that we see fitting in here. Next February 15th, which is the same date that the recidivism reduction plan in the operating budget that Mr. Jesse mentioned is due. So I've got a couple of handouts that were distributed by Mr. Prax earlier this morning via email. I've currently got copies of those. If you'd like, I can discuss those. But I'll just go quickly through B1 through 7, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman. So B1 looks to, and this is on lines 20 through 22 of the first page of L.5, looks into currently operating grant programs, contracts, and services of both DHSS and the Department of Corrections that may be suitable for social impact financing. These are the nonprofit programs that are all marching towards the same direction. B2 looks for private sector investors that can provide social impact financing, whether that's Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, or an institutional investor of a similar type. B3 looks for guarantors that provide guarantees for funds invested by private sector investors. These are philanthropic backers, such as the Bloomberg Foundation, the Rasmussen Foundation, potentially, and this is just conjecture at this point, that could guarantee a portion of the private sector's capital. One example that is currently in operation is the Rikers Island Social Impact Bond. It's not a bond in the traditional sense, it's a contract, as I've mentioned previously. The Bloomberg Foundation backed up $7.2 million of Goldman Sachs' $9.6 million investment. And what I mean by that is, if the outcomes are not achieved according to the evaluation that the neutral evaluator provides, then Goldman Sachs will not lose everything that they've invested. They will lose, I believe it's $2.4 million. But the Bloomberg Foundation is backing up their initial investment. B4 looks into the programs operated by nonprofit corporations that could be funded through a social impact financing mechanism. There are a number of nonprofits that are operating both within and outside of the Department of Corrections institutions that really could have a very strong impact if they were scaled up and were able to achieve the capacity to operate in the manner to achieve the greatest impact. For example, there's nonprofit program A, which currently has a capacity of 40 former prisoners a month to look into, you know, bringing them back into the population in the Anchorage area. They have a capacity of around 40 prisoners a month. The Anchorage Correctional Complex releases around, I believe, 200 prisoners a month into the Anchorage area. Scale up that capacity and that nonprofit could have a greater impact. B5 discusses the independent evaluators, which I previously mentioned, that come in at the end of the agreed-upon time horizon to determine whether or not the outcomes have been achieved. This is an outcome-based idea. It is not about outputs. It's not about saying, we put this many people through this program. It's about saying, so what? It's about saying, these many people went through the program, and 80% of them did not reoffend within 3 years. B6 asks the Mental Health Trust Authority, in working in concert with the Department of Corrections and the Department of Health and Social Services, to determine whether federal funding is available for independent evaluators participating in social impact financing evaluation. Currently in the FY 2015 federal budget, there is around $350 million available for social impact financing mechanisms. And this is they call them pay-for-success contracts at the federal level. And finally, B7 asks to look at the cost savings to the state from reductions in recidivism. And one that I will show, handout that was distributed earlier today, is this particular handout right here. And this is the contract that the city government of New York signed with Goldman Sachs and nonprofit service providers to say if recidivism gets reduced by 20%, then the city payment to Goldman Sachs is going to be $11.7 million. Goldman Sachs makes $2.1 million worth of profit. However, this is at the same time that the projected long-term net savings to the city of government of New York will be $20.5 million. It's an innovative concept. It's an innovative policy instrument. It's a great way to bring market forces to bear on public sector problems and really bring the market's expertise in analyzing what is a good idea and what is a bad idea to bear on these pernicious social ills that that you all are facing as a state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for allowing me.
Thank you. I'm sure we'll have a couple questions, but I have one first. You talk here about mental health trust being involved in this. The commissioners, have you worked with them so far? I mean, to date, have you been talking to Jeff Jesse and Bill Struver?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have spoken to Mr. Jesse, and I would not be one to put words in his mouth, but I believe that his organization does have the capacity to do this sort of operation.
The reason I bring that up is simply because this is taking his words to heart. You know, we want to be judicious about handling SB 64. This is obviously an exciting and fun thought to explore, and we're not going to have a whole lot of time to vet the issue like we normally would. And I bring it up because anybody on the committee that wants to talk about this, include Ted and Jeff and the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, and we'll get to whether or not we're going to act on the bill on Friday. Representative Millett.
Thank you. I noticed that it's a study and will require a report. What's the fiscal note on this amendment? There doesn't seem to be any cost associated with it, is my first question. Second, it seems like it doesn't fit within the bill because it sounds like it's a standalone bill all on its own. It sounds like it would be better served as a standalone piece of legislation than rather in a complicated crime omnibus bill where we are already setting up a sentencing commission and now we're doing a social impact finance study and report and recidivism reduction. I guess my two questions are, what's the fiscal cost of this amendment, and why wouldn't you do this as a standalone bill? It seems like it would make more sense to me.
Thank you very much. Representative Millett, through the chair. I am not certain about the fiscal cost of creating this study through my conversations with Mr. Jesse, and once again, not putting words into his mouth. I don't believe that this will impact his organization's bottom line in terms of the amount, because it could work in concert very much with the recidivism reduction plan that is currently conceived in the operating budget. In terms of why this component is here, because the recidivism reduction grant fund currently in operation in Senate Bill 64 will go a long way towards making sure that recidivism reduction does happen in the state of Alaska. This is another avenue that could potentially really impact and really drive down Alaska's recidivism rates. And I see the two options as operating in concert.
You know, I'm not sure that it belongs in this bill. I mean, at this late stage of the game. But I think this is an utterly fascinating idea, just an absolutely fascinating idea, so that if it doesn't happen this session, this is something that I'd like to work on in the future.
Representative Ledoux, I'm of the same opinion. That's why I kind of twisted the rules a little bit to get this on the table for Representative Grunberg and Ted, because I think it's a great idea, you know, that we need to be explored. But we aren't making a decision right now on whether or not we're going to act on the bill, okay? I just wanted to say one more thing. Go ahead, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you.
We move on.
When Mr. Jesse spoke a few minutes ago, he was not aware of your conversation with me a few minutes ago, and we'll be talking to him. I want to say that this is entirely due to Ted. He's in a master's program. And he said if I let him go back to New Hampshire for the master's program, that he'd do some kind of a minor bill.
With that, one of the last comment I wanted to make is that we will want to hear from Jordan and Senator Coghill on this, you know, if the committee proceeds to decide on what to go, you know, will this be for Friday? And also the other amendments that come up, I'm going to ask you to come up and give me your position on it as we go, because we didn't do that on the First Amendment, and it's like Representative Ledoux said, you probably saw the tea leaves also. So, with that, Representative Grunberg, would you withdraw your motion to move the bill?
Oh, sure.
Okay, then I'll put it on the bottom of the list,
sure.
And it's still there pending. So, thank you.
Oh.
Sure, yeah. At ease. just for clarification, backing up a little bit, make very sure we have this. Would you remove your objection? No, that isn't what you want. Would you remove your, make an official motion to withdraw your motion to move this amendment? There we go.
Mr. Chair, for clarification first, this amendment, which was labeled L.5, should be, for the committee's use, labeled amendment number 2. And I, with the chair's permission, having done that, will request unanimous consent to withdraw the motion to move the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg. And I think we've got all the rules stuff done. And thank you, Ted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next amendment before us is one that's labeled upper right-hand corner, L.10.
Amendment number three.
Thank you. This came up, if I'm remembering right, from Quinlan Steiner. And if you've looked at it, if not, do you mind Ernest telling us, giving us just a little bit, while everybody's looking in the bill, it's on page 12, line 29, if you don't mind taking the stand. Do I have a motion to move the bill? Or move the amendment?
I move amendment number 3.
The bill would be good, yeah.
Your amendment, but I will move amendment number 3.
Okay, is there objection?
I'll object for purposes.
Thank you. It's a good thing I got good help, you know? Identify yourself for the record and tell us what amendment number 3 does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ernest Brock, staff to Rep. Keller. Amendment 3 that you have before you was a recommendation by Mr. Steiner. This deals with the Nigrin credit language. Mr. Steiner thought that the language was a bit ambiguous in that the way it was worded, that it could be interpreted that an assessment of all residents and not the applicant could be, that the assessment of, you know, the behavior of all the residents, whether they were good or not, could be interpreted as whether to give that particular individual a pass. And so the intent of the amendment is to change it to the singular to make absolutely clear that we're looking at the particular individual, not the behavior of everybody there. That's the general gist of the amendment, and Jordan from Senator Coghill's office can elaborate and give this the senator's perspective.
Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. So this amendment was brought to us by Quinlan Steiner. I believe he's on the line and should be able to answer questions. You know, any time we discuss changing this section 23, it always makes us a little bit uneasy because of how, you know, arduous of a process it was to get to this language. And we were able to get to an area where the Department of Law and the public defenders were in agreement, which was difficult. And so always a little bit reluctant to make tweaks, but this, I believe, is a reasonable change. Senator Coghill believes so. The Department of Law can speak to this as well. They're in the room today, but it's a reasonable change, and I think it's prudent.
Okay. Thank you.
I will remove my objection.
Any other objections? Amendment number three passes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
We did pass amendment number one. And I don't know if you could, and then you subsequently said that you wanted Jordan to state if he had any position on amendments. We hadn't asked him to comment on amendment number one. Are we going to do that?
I had not asked him to comment on amendment number one, but Representative Grunberg, if you'd like to ask him, go ahead and do that. No,
I wouldn't. But I thought, just to be sure, I didn't want the record to think we had overlooked it.
I see.
I'm making a specific.
Chairman Keller, I did have the sponsor's approval to do the 750 change.
Oh.
I did have the sponsor's approval to do the change to the amendment. It was a friendly amendment to the bill.
That's good. I never ask a witness a question unless I know the answer.
Okay, that brings us to amendment number L11, which we're going to call amendment number four. And I see no names on it, so it looks like it's one that I have to move here. Is there objection?
I'll object for a discussion.
Okay, we have L11, and we're going to call it number four. And what I'm going to do again is turn to my staff and Jordan.
For the record, Ernest Prox, Staff Rep Keller. Amendment four is labeled L11. This is electronic monitoring for first-time DUI offenders, if I recall correctly. And what happened is that it was due to a drafting error. It was mistakenly taken out of Senate Bill 64. This amendment, there is, if you remember back when we were in, we had a judiciary hearing back in Fairbanks, it was like November or something like that, there was there's a alleged research report that looked at the potential cost savings between keeping the first-time offendant in jail or halfway house for 3 days versus putting them on electronic monitoring. And so they looked at the potential cost savings, and it was, on average, you're looking between $800,000 to $1 million in savings each year. And so that was what was the purpose of putting the electronic monitoring into Senate Bill 64, and it was just mistakenly taken out, so it just puts it back in. And Jordan can comment further.
Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. That's exactly right. It was a drafting error that occurred in the Senate Judiciary, and a shame to admit that none of us noticed it. So this is an attempt to put it back in. Anchorage is already operating under this policy. The Anchorage Assembly passed something to this effect several years ago. This is an attempt to put the rest of the state under the same guidelines.
And none of us have ever made a mistake, Jordan, so you're in trouble admitting that you actually made a mistake.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I remove my objection.
Any further objection to number four? Mm-hmm. Okay, amendment number four passes. That brings us to amendment number five, which is labeled up in the corner, L.12. And by Gardner. And like I say, we're calling this amendment number five. And I'll move the amendment because nobody's name's on it.
I'll object for her.
Okay, and that brings us back to Ernest. It's the report one.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ernest Prox again. This, if you look on page 17 of the L version of Senate Bill 64, which is before us, it is section 29, and this is, I think, the duties of the Commissioner for Corrections. The new language in Senate Bill 64, it directs the Commissioner to establish a program to conduct assessments of the risks and needs of offenders sentenced to a term of incarceration of 30 days or more. In one of the drafts, I think, of Senate Bill 64, there was a requirement that they put together a report and give it to the legislature. It was taken out. Jordan can go into further explanation of that. This amendment would put the report requirement back in. I think it's something that if the Department of Corrections is going to conduct an assessment on in the effort of the legislature to better address recidivism and crime in general. It's information that would be good to, you know, just explicitly state we want to be notified and read about it.
A question, Ernest. What when does this bill go into effect if it passes this session?
Mr. Chairman, Jordan can answer that. I'd have to go look at it.
Jordan, did you want to add your perspective? Maybe you didn't really answer that.
Yeah, Jordan, Staff Senator Cockle. Some of the sections of the bill go into effect later than the overall effective date of the bill. So this specific section that we're talking about goes into effect January 1, 2016. And so what the section says is that the Department of Corrections is now required to conduct many more assessments than they currently conduct. And what this amendment would say is, as a result of all of the new assessments you're conducting, the legislature would like to see a report on the results of that.
The reason for my question is, should we put on there January 15th starting in such a year? I mean, in other words, we don't want to get in a position, right, of forcing them to report before anything's up and running?
Mr. Chairman, if Doug Gardner is online, the drafter of the bill, he may be able to answer if that's necessary.
Okay. Doug, are you online?
I am Representative Keller, and I think I heard the question. And the question is, with respect to Section 29 of the bill, when does it take effect? That's the essence of what I heard. Is that right?
You said January 1st, 2016. The real question is whether or not we should put a date specific on here so we don't force a partial report. Do you have a feel for that?
Well, Representative Keller, I guess I don't. I mean, that portion of the act doesn't even take effect until January 1st of 2016. That would seem to allow the time necessary to get ready to do the report. Looking at the amendment, we could put a date of, If the committee wanted to, it could say by January 15th or another date that the committee feels is appropriate. I suppose the logical thing would be to put January 15th, 2017 in there, would seem to me, but I'm not trying to direct the committee, but obviously a later date might work.
Oh, okay, I'll think about that a little bit. Did you have a question? Anyone? I saw a hand.
I did, yeah.
Representative
Well,
Mullett?
My question was just the same thing. It's just a conceptual amendment to add 2017 because that defines when the first report is due and it goes in effect on the. I think it would be smart for us to lay out when the first report is done so we don't get a partial report next year or the year following.
Is that a conceptual amendment you're making?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a conceptual amendment to add the year 2017 after 15.
I'm going to object for discussion.
Sure. We've got an objection. Representative,
I need to restate. She didn't hear me. I'm sorry.
Okay. Representative Miller?
My conceptual amendment is adding 2017 after 15 on line 2 of the amendment.
And Representative Grunberg objected. Explain.
I'm going to make a request. I would suggest that you take a little time to figure the best date, and we do that as a separate amendment on Friday when you all can confer on this, because you can't just have it effective on the date that things do. They have to have enough time to be doing the work, and I would suggest you take a little time and come up with the best date, and we could just take that as a separate amendment on that date.
Through the chair, that was Doug Gardner's suggestion to have it due on 2017 because that's when the report would take effect.
Through the chair, I understand, but what they're talking about here isn't a due date for the. What you're talking about. January 15, 2017, as when the first report is due. I'm talking about something a little bit different. And that's the effective date clause at the back of the bill. Because this thing, as it is now, is, if you look on the last page, it doesn't take effect until January 1st, 2016. I don't know how much time. That may be as good a date as any, but I was just wondering.
Through the chair, it's a yearly report, Representative Groenberg.
Yeah.
So it coincides with the effective date.
Representative Groenberg, if you would, are you going to withdraw your objection? If not, I'll just call for the vote because it'll put it in the bill. The effect will be that 2017 will go in the bill, and then we will get a chance to review it.
Oh, I see. The effective date be something different.
Yes.
Yeah, I withdraw my objection.
Okay. Any further objection?
No.
Seeing none, okay.
And I withdraw my objection from amendment number 5.
And... seeing no objection. So, amendment number 5, as conceptually amended, is passed. Next amendment I have in front of me is L.13, and that we're going to call amendment number 6. And then there's no name on it, so I will move it. I move that we adopt amendment number 6.
I'll check for a conversation.
Okay.
For the record, Ernest Prox, staff rep color. I'll let Jordan explain this one.
Okay.
Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Cockhill. So if the committee members could turn to page 17, I'd just like to point one thing out. 17 is where we have the commission, and it's where we say who is on the commission. And in here, you'll see that these commission members are serving 3-year terms. Well, currently, the commission has a 4-year sunset on it. And so you can see how that would be a little problematic with a 3-year term. So rather than adjust the term length, Senator Coghill suggested that perhaps in an effort to be fiscally prudent, we just cut back a little bit on the sunset of the commission. And in this case, it would be cutting about 6 months off the commission to make the term dates sync up a little bit better with the duration of the commission.
Any questions? Do you maintain your objection?
I'll remove my objection.
See no further objection. Amendment number 6 passes. Now we're looking at amendment number L15. I'm going to take a little of ease here. I just want to explain on the record, the question was asked what we mean here by the bottom of the pile. And we're going through these things. We've numbered them, one through whatever. And the ones that we're not passing, there's two of them. One of them we didn't really discuss, and that's the one on the interlock and the 24/7. And then number one, when we did number one, we put that on the bottom of the pile. In other words, it's there with the other amendment that we still have to address. So it's one that we didn't act on today that we're going to try to act on Friday after we have another CS to work on. So it puts a lot of load on legal services to continually draft this stuff for us. So the farther we can get down the road and getting this stuff in, the better, it'll cut the labor down for them later. So,
Mr. Chairman, just so I'm clear, the only amendment that we haven't taken up so far is amendment number 1, which is yours. We have put that one aside. Representative Groenberg removed amendment number 2, which was the social impact financing study, correct? That one was withdrawn. And every other amendment we've had has passed. So we just have amendment number 1 to the side so far.
No, I'm glad you asked. I'm really glad you asked. Amendment number 1 is Representative Millett's.
Okay, so that amendment. One passed.
That passed. That was.
And so what is your amendment, this amendment?
We it's L.2 at this point, okay, because so it has not been up for discussion. It hasn't been offered. Okay. So.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's my intent to talk
at ease. On the record, we've got our numbering system straightened out. The first item we talked about today we called it LDOT 2 because it's up in the corner, but it was never offered. So it was never given an amendment number. So the first amendment number one was labeled LDOT 4, and that's the one by Representative Millett. And then LDOT 5, Representative Gruenberg's, we named that number 2, and we put it to the bottom of the pile, which I explained later just means that we're putting it off till later. And then LDOT 10 was next, and that we called that amendment number 3. LDOT 11, we called number 4. LDOT 12, we called amendment number 5. LDOT 13, we called number 6. And that brings us to LDOT 15.
Which will be amendment 7?
Number 7.
Okay, and then can we continue down and do L16 as amendment number 8?
Okay, L16, we'll call number 8.
And L19 will be number 9, is that correct?
L19 is number 9. L19 is number 9.
And then L.20 would be amendment number 10.
Yeah.
Okay, and that'll get us through the pile and...
Yes, and then we'll have we'll all have amendments right.
Yeah.
Missing 19, and then we 20. Is that it?
There's
20.
There's
19. Oh, okay. All right.
The one we're on now is.
We should number these before we put them out on the table.
Okay, at ease. 15 by Representative Gruenberg, and that is amendment number 7.
Thank you. I move the amendment for discussion.
I object for discussion.
Okay. Mr. Chair, this is the same as the bill we introduced, which was suggested by Ledge Legal. It cures a problem when somebody is being transported from one treatment or residential facility to another and walks away from the van. Very simple cures. Supposed to just cure a loophole. And the reason I don't know what Mr. Steiner's issue is, but I would request that with that he be allowed to state what his problem is and see what we can do about it.
Quinlan, are you in line listening? Did you get all the numbers straight?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Quinlan. Did you have a problem with number 7, amendment number 7 as it's offered?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. What this amendment does is sort of extends a criminal penalty to what has traditionally been handled as a parole or probation violation matter, and that is the favored policy for handling those type of conduct violations espoused in various arenas, particularly the Model Penal Code. And what I mean by this is it's not a loophole in the sense that somebody's getting away with it when they walk away. When somebody violates a condition of their parole or probation, it's handled by a parole or probation violation report. So it's handled in a swifter, certain, proportional manner that could include jail time, but it wouldn't come with the full prosecution of a crime. In effect, what it would do is undermine the function of parole and probation to a significant degree, which is to promote rehabilitation and reentry. And that is best accomplished with a relationship between a parole officer and probation officer and the parolee or probationer through the administrative proceedings or court proceedings that go along specific to that. You'd be elevating this to a criminal prosecution on some undefined language. What exists now for criminal prosecution, say in a furlough or something like that, you have direct orders, you're committed to corrections, and then you're given leave through statute. Here you just have language like assigned to a treatment facility, assigned by who, for, you know, and how formal is that assignment, and what kind of residential facility are you talking about? It leaves open prosecution with sort of a kind of a loose definition.
Mr. Chair.
I think that would have the unintended consequence of really actually undermining the rehabilitation and reentry function.
Representative Gruenberg has a question for you.
Well, I think in light of that, I'd like to withdraw the amendment, and I'll talk with Mr. Steiner and Ms. Carpinetti and anybody else who may have an interest. I certainly didn't intend to complicate this at all, and I'll report to the committee what we do. And if we do something, it may be a separate bill or something.
Okay, so the bill, the amendment is withdrawn. Amendment number 8 is L.16.
And that's my amendment. Okay. And what I would like to do, Mr. Chairman, is I'd like to move the amendment for purposes of discussion, and then I would like to withdraw the amendment while I have an opportunity to talk to the bill sponsor about it, and then put it, and you can put it to the bottom of the pile, as you were.
Would you move the amendment?
Yes, I move amendment number 8.
And I object. Go ahead.
Thank you. Amendment number 8 is we've got a huge problem over in Northeast Anchorage and probably in the rest of Anchorage also with derelicts purchasing liquor. The red stripe in the driver's license just doesn't seem to be working. And so what amendment number 8 does basically is it requires the alcohol beverage folks to provide to the liquor dispensers a list of people who are on a no-sell list because they either have driven drunk or they've done some other thing while they are intoxicated, subjecting themselves to the criminal laws. And but the red stripe has not worked. Give that to the liquor dispensers so that those people are not sold alcohol, so they don't populate our public parks and do all of the things that people do when they are intoxicated. And I would just like the opportunity to chat with the bill sponsor about this and see whether or not we can do something about it this year.
Mr.
Question.
I do have a question. I think this is a great idea. It's sort of like the sex offenders list, and it could be accessed through a computer base that operators, liquor stores, and bars could have on hand, right? Is that
yes,
what you're...
Yes, that's idea.
That's the idea. Not a book, but an actual computer site they could log into. Each bar would have a login, and they could search for the name.
You know, I can't say for sure that this bill provides the computer, but, I mean, obviously, if there is a way of doing it by computer, then that's the way it would be done.
Well, we have Representative Linden and Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, I like the idea, but I'm trying to think from the standpoint of the, say, the liquor store owner. First of all, how many of these people are we talking about running around the place? What's the number of this? And every time you're going to buy a bottle of booze or something, he has to go to a book or the computer or something to see this person's name is on the list, and how much problem is that for the store owner? I can see a big problem, and it's not quite the same as sex offender list because, you know, I check that list periodically who's in my neighborhood, but I do that, you know, I don't have 20 customers standing in front of me while I try to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it is done by computer, I mean, all it would mean is sticking the name into the computer and up it pops.
Well, that's
I'm sorry.
That's simply my concern. We need to look at that.
Yep.
We have to, people trying to operate a business here.
And I think that I appreciate the comments. And when you talk to the sponsor, you can bring these things up that came up, and then you'll have a better feel. Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, so I'm going to give a just kind of throw something out there. So Joe Smith goes in, and his name gets flagged. Just like when the FBI takes 3 days to come back if your name's flagged when you look up their information. So now this individual says, I want to buy alcohol, I have no problem. And there's 15 people out there named Joe Smith that happen to be on here. Already the problem with the red stripe is that they don't take in their license, they're taking in a passport. Passport doesn't have the address on there. I mean, I don't know that we're really solving the red stripe problem with this. It's a great idea, but I think that we're going to put honest citizens in a place of not being able to purchase this because we're trying to fix a law that we put in place before that we haven't been able to figure out how to make it work. And that's the person that's the honest person that I'm concerned about here. It's a great idea because it's the problem that you're talking about. It's rampant in our side of town. It's rampant. It's in Fairview and whatnot. But I think that we may hit other snags, and we'd be hurting the people that are the honest people here. And I don't know that. And I think that's just a burden right now that. I'd be frustrated if I walked in there and every time they said, nope, you come back in 3 days and we'll know if you're actually the one that we can sell alcohol to. That's just not going to work.
Well, we have Representative Foster, too, so go ahead and follow up.
Okay, well, Section 27 of the bill provides that the Department of Public Safety shall provide the person's name, age, date of birth, height, weight, and photographic image. So, I mean, that would be something which would help to keep the honest purchaser of liquor who is allowed to purchase the liquor from getting confused with a John Smith who has, you know, a string of DWIs.
So then let me throw in, so now then here's the other question. So now are we going to mandate that every liquor store, everyone that sells, has the ability to look up all of this information? Now we've just put a burden on that business owner. And we just need to be cognizant, if that's the policy decision that we're going to make, we just need to be cognizant that we are putting that burden on them. And I would suspect that there would probably be some pushback, if not some sort of, and not just pushback in we don't want it. If we're going to mandate something on them and not pay for it, I would expect some sort of pushback in terms of a group. So. Again, good idea. It might be something that we need to look at the interim and see if it's actually something that we can work on, come back next year and handle it separately. Try to put it in at this point in time in a very large bill. It might derail the bill, and this is a good bill. And so, good idea. Not trying to derail it. I just think we may need to spend a little bit more time on it and maybe come back with it.
Chairman Keller.
Representative Foster is mine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is actually my favorite amendment out of all the amendments, but with the caveat. But some of the questions that have been raised, Representative Lynn, I think, I think back to Nome, and I know that we have some liquor stores that are just mom-and-pop liquor stores, and they don't even have an internet connection in there. And for the ones that do, we have sometimes intermittent internet connections. So even though you've got the internet, sometimes it just goes down. And so then, you know, if you've got a line of people that are waiting to buy, does that mean that you can't buy now? So again, I really like the intent of this. And if there's some way that, you know, we can make it work, I'd love to see it work. So thanks.
While you're waiting, you're going to DTs.
Chairman Keller.
Yes.
And I think, you know, as we talk about this over the interim, I think it could be a voluntary thing. I know people in Fairview would love to have it, and it could be in book form. It doesn't have to be in internet form. But what I'm saying is I think there are communities that would be very receptive to this, especially in Fairview and Mountain View and some of the places that have them. So I would love to work on this with you because I think it does have some values. And by the way, a passport is not an okay ID. to buy a drink with. I found that out this weekend when I lost my driver's license and wanted a glass of wine. Passports are not allowed to be used.
Representative Lynn?
I just like to make it not just Mountain View and Fairview. You know, we have people with serious alcohol problems all over town and all over the state and not just one neighborhood or another.
Okay, would you like to withdraw your amendment for now? I think you've got plenty of information to explore, and you can determine what, you know, if you want to proceed.
Thank you. I move to withdraw amendment number 9?
8.
8.
Representative Ledoux, number 8 is withdrawn. That brings us to L19, number 9, amendment number 9, I should say. We named it that. Representative Gruenberg.
Mr. Chair, I, without going into this at the moment, this is a work in progress, and I move that it goes to the bottom of the pile.
Representative Gruenberg, I will put it to the bottom of the pile, but just for the record, you know, what we've been doing is demonstrating the need to be judicious, to use Jeff Jesse's terminology. And so when you look at this amendment, I have closely, even though I really like the idea and the previous committee liked the idea, it also fills the saddlebags on this on this bill, so I'm just a natural reaction.
Chairman Keller, I also think that this bill, I think there's a bill in the hopper somewhere in the legislature
Yeah, there is.
There's an active bill, so I don't think we can pull a bill out of another committee and put
this
it.
This committee, it's in this.
Oh, is it in this committee?
Okay, so that brings us, then we're not offering that amendment at this time. How about number 10? Looks like that's mine. I move amendment number 10.
I'll object.
Okay, we have an objection, and I'm going to go back to my staff and Senator Coghill's staff.
It's number 20, L20.
Amendment number 10.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ernest Pronick, staff to Rep. Keller. Amendment 10 before you represents perhaps my only opportunity to spill red ink on somebody's bill.
If I could jump in and interrupt, I want to give a little bit of background on this amendment. Jordan and Ernest have worked on this, and I think they've done a great job in clarifying some of the language, and I don't think it takes there may be one or two new things in there. I know there's one because I put it in there, but what the point is that they have gone and cleaned up the language on the bill, and I think it just I just really commend them for what they did, but go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the changes that we made is that originally the commission started out as a sentencing commission and eventually was morphed into a criminal justice commission. And so some of the changes where you see the, kind of the addition of criminal justice or criminal justice practices, it's to kind of update or kind of modify the language to better reflect the overall intent of the commission. There was also, I believe, there's also, if you look at another addition that Jordan and I had worked on was, if you look at line 8 of the amendment, page 18, line 29, this is under the powers and duties of the commission. We inserted as one of the things that the commission shall evaluate. We added the rights of the accused and the person convicted. You know, obviously, there's great concern about the person who has been wronged in an action. However, we are all to be treated equally under law, whether you are the convicted or the or the victim. And so, that was something to highlight for the commission to ensure that when we are prosecuting people who violate state laws or commit harm against another person, that the accused's rights are maintained as well. There's also in this amendment there's some language that talks about just sharpening the focus on rehabilitation and restitution to society and for the convicted. It's easy to throw somebody in jail, but we also have a problem of what do you do with them after they get out of jail. Page 19, line 2. This was actually a suggestion that came out of the meeting we had up in Fairbanks. It was one of the members had suggested adding, court rules at, a second. It directs the commission to consider statutes in court rules related to the sentencing of criminal defendants. During our meeting up in Fairbanks, there was a suggestion by one of the members that we also put in their relevant court decisions, and so that's just adding that in there. I'm just kind of picking a few examples. Page 19, line 17. We deleted out the number 9, which says we're still on things that the commission shall consider truth and certainty in statutes and sentencing practices. In kind of my discussions with Jordan, it was sort of an ambiguous ambiguous phrase, and so we thought you just might as well just get rid of it. Doesn't hurt. We didn't think it would harm the bill. Page 19, line 20. This one. Lines 19 through 20. 20 through 26.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunberg?
I went through this in some detail and flagged a few issues. Since these are each sort of mini amendments on their own, would you have a problem if I have a question or anybody does, that we could interrupt at that point in the discussion?
That's fine.
Could I go back with that?
Sure.
One thing. Through the chair. Mr. Prax.
One thing. I have to leave, Labor Congressman. I have the objection, so can someone else object so I don't have to come back to remove it?
I'll object. I'll put the objection.
Okay.
Okay.
You removed your objection?
Well, I just had someone else object.
So the bill moved? I mean, the amendment moved?
No.
I know.
My objection.
I'm sorry. Way too much fun for the end of the day. Representative Grunberg.
Okay. I'd like to go back, Mr. Prax, to page 19, line 6, which appears in the amendment on page 1, lines 18 through 20. And if the members would look at the bill, at the amendment itself, it's really, but you can see where it goes. You're deleting "and proportionality," and you're inserting "proportionality and accountability." My question is, what is proportionality? I'm not familiar with the term.
Mr. Chairman, through the record, Representative Grunberg.
This is Ernest.
For the record, Ernest Franks. The proportionality, that was, as far as I know from all the drafts, I think that's been in Senate Bill 64, for the most part, for the get-go. Proportionality, I believe that it's, you know, if you're sentencing a person for, a minor theft, that you're not giving him a life sentence in jail. I think that's kind of, you know, does the punishment, does it kind of fit the nature of the crime, I believe, is kind of the idea behind proportionality. But Jordan can also explain on that one.
Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. That's exactly right. The punishment must fit the crime. It must be proportional to the action that was done. That's at least how I read it. Also, I just wanted to point out the powers and duties and methodologies that are contained within Senate Bill 64 are really pulled directly from the exact same powers and duties that the Alaska Sentencing Commission had back in the early 90s.
If I may, Mr. Chair. So that is a term that is used elsewhere in Alaska law.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I'm not familiar if it's used elsewhere in statute.
I will reserve any comment, and I'll the next few days check that out.
Okay. Go ahead, then. Can you continue where you were there, Ernest?
For the record, Ernest Prox, again. Okay, yeah, we're on, if you're looking at the amendment, page 2, lines 21 through 24.
May I, Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. As I say, I have a few things here. I'd like the members to look on page 2 of the amendment, lines 13 through 15. That deals with, again, page 19, line 18, removes the word effectiveness and inserts usability. And I think effectiveness is a good term, and it's well understood. And I'm wondering what was the, through the chair, to Mr. Prax or to Jordan, what's wrong with effectiveness, and why is that being removed?
For the record, Ernest Prox, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I thought that effectiveness was too broad and too vague, so I thought that usability is a more, it kind of, you know, gets down to the heart of the matter of, the state's methodologies for collecting and disseminating criminal justice data. Is it the methodology? Is it in a format that can actually, can it be used by somebody, or are we just gathering data to store in a computer database or report that nobody understands? So that was the reason for putting in usability.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Grunberg,
I at the appropriate time if you entertain amendments to the amendment. I think I will suggest that we leave effectiveness in and just delete that particular.
You'll have that option. Okay, go ahead.
And may I continue, please?
Representative Bruce.
The next is page 19, line 19. Dissemination. Normally you would say collection and dissemination. Extrapolation, we certainly can put that in, but dissemination is getting the information out. So I really don't have any particular problem with inserting extrapolation, but at the appropriate time, I think I will move an amendment to leave the word dissemination in as well. Any comment?
Ernest, do you have a comment on that?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg. Looking at my notes, it looks like I had thought it would be collection and dissemination and extrapolation. But you know, either way, I don't have a position on it.
Okay,
one or the
you
other.
Can keep that one. Consider that, and then. Did you have another question now?
Well, my next one, just to cut to the chase on page 2, is lines 21 through 26 on page 19. It looks like that deals with the specific things that they would like the consultants to do.
Let's let him explain. He hasn't gotten to that one, right? Or have
I'm
you?
Sorry.
No. Ernest?
Thank you.
Representative Keller. So this section dealt with kind of the things that the commission may do, and Jordan and I were talking about it. The part where it says the commission may. The way it's worded now, if you look in the bill, page 19, lines 21 through 22, it says the commission may select and retain the services of consultants whose advice is considered necessary to assist the commission in obtaining information. I thought that you know, part of that sentence was kind of redundant, or it was just kind of a given. That's kind of what we expect you to do. We don't need a stated in statute. Then for kind of similar lines along numbers 2 and 3 as things that the commission may do, and you know, number 2, it's page 19, lines 23 and 24, and 3 is 25 and 26. Number 2 states accumulate and compile information concerning sentencing practices. Number 3, recommend legislative and administrative action on the sentencing practices. For number 2, I think kind of just thought that it's something that we kind of already expect the commission to do, so why do you need to state it in statute? You know, is it language that really needs to be in there? It's kind of thought that it's just a given. Number 3, this one, it seemed that there was – this kind of seemed to be a little bit redundant. If you look on page 20 – lines 18 through 22. This is the annual report and recommendations, and it says that the commission shall submit to the governor legislature an annual report and may submit recommendations for legislative and administrative action. So it seemed that it's kind of already said in another section of the bill, so why do you need it?
Okay. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg?
Back on that earlier point, the legislature sometimes gets in trouble for just hiring consultants, high-priced consultants, and often the minority swipes the majority for doing this, and sometimes that's warranted and sometimes not. And it seemed to me, and I'm looking at the first two subsections, lines 21 through 24, that somewhat specifies what the consultants shall be doing, and I think it may eliminate some of the question on whether the consultants are necessary, and frankly, allow good consultants to be hired and make sure there's some accountability. So that was my reason for doing that. I didn't realize that the language on recommending legislative and administrative action was on the other page. I'm going to suggest that we do retain that in so people don't have to look under the annual report and recommendations, but this is under what the commission will do. I think it's nothing wrong with having that there. So I'll be pursuing that at the appropriate time.
I have a question for you on that. Did you mean line 20 through 26 or 21 to 26? Oh, me. No, I see. Never mind. I'm with you now.
It was in the previous.
I see it.
Yeah, it's the, yeah. Mr. Chairman, the way it seems to read is that the commission may do 1, 2, and 3. It doesn't seem to me to say that it kind of extrapolates to what the consultants can do. It seems to be that commission does 1, 2, or 3. It's not kind of discussing kind of what the, further expanding what the consultants. That's how I read it.
Yep, that's true. I engaged my mouth before I engaged my brain. Go ahead, if you would.
A second. Okay. Let's see here. Another change. Page 19, line 31. We're deleting criminals and adding administering justice. So the way it would read now, under the kind of the first point for methodology, under the new language, the way it would read is the commission shall solicit and consider information and views from a variety of constituencies to represent the broad spectrum of views that exist with respect to possible approaches to sentencing and administering justice in the state. And that change was to kind of further highlight that we are, that the commission is a criminal justice commission, not just a criminal sentencing commission. Let's see here, page 20, lines 14 through 15. We're on the section that's on the methodology and the things that the commission shall base recommendations on for the following factors. The one that we're looking at right now is the way it's currently worded, the resources available to agencies in the criminal justice system. I thought a better way or more direct way to state it is, the sufficiency in state agency resources, because they have, all state agencies have resources. That's a given. Whether they are sufficient in actually doing what they're supposed to do, that's perhaps a better question to take a look at.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I'm just going to have one suggestion. If we look at the amendment on page 3, line 5, I think the correct term should be the sufficiency of agency resources rather than in resources. So I'll make that grammatical suggestion.
Page
20, line 16 on the amendment. Page 20, line 16 of the bill. It's letter J. This one states the effect of sentencing on reducing the rate of recidivism. We changed it so that would now read the effect of criminal justice laws and practices on reducing the rate of recidivism, just to kind of better reflect the overall goals that we're trying to meet. Some additional factors that the commission shall base recommendations on. The first one is peer-reviewed and data-driven research, the effect of over-classification on prisoners. This was something that was brought up a little bit during the Fairbanks Judiciary Committee hearing. I think Ron Taylor was the one that talked about it, that there's prisoners can be, I guess, deemed to be more dangerous to society than they really are, and so it can I think is potentially had an impact on their ability to successfully rehabilitate and integrate into society. If Jordan wants to kind of discuss this a little bit more, he certainly can. And then this letter M, this was a suggestion by the chairman. This would add the effects of evidence-based restoration. The effects of evidence-based restorative justice initiatives on persons convicted of criminal violations and offenses, the victim and community. And I think I believe the intent is to focus on making the victim whole, that we don't want to lose sight of just throwing the person in jail and calling it quits after that, that if there has been a harm committed against the individual, part of the the punishment or in is that there that the perpetrator should restore the damages suffered by the victim. I think that, and so there's it's been kind of addressed a little bit in state policy, but there needs to be a greater emphasis on that particular element.
I could just add one thought to that. It's not just the victim; it's also the perpetrator. There's a lot of evidence out there now in the restorative justice initiatives that have been taken that the perpetrator benefits from an atoning effort, to make the victim whole, and that's a concept that's tied to restorative justice. So, okay, well, I guess that gets us to the point where are there any suggested amendments to Amendment Number 10?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Okay, just to recap. First, on page 1, lines 18 through 20, I will check that out, and I'll defer that discussion till Friday. Next is page 2, lines 13 through 15, which deals with the bill on page 19, line 18, change effectiveness to usability. I think effectiveness in there, they're talking about the effectiveness of the methodologies. That is exactly right, I think, and usability is less clear to me, and I would move we delete that from the amendment. That would be Amendment 1 to the amendment.
I will object, and that's we're talking about deletion on the Amendment Number 10, page 2, lines 13 through 15. I'll speak to my objection. I just mostly objected to see if anybody else had anything to say, because I'm kind of ambivalent. So, Representative Levin?
I think that Representative Grunberg is probably correct on this. I think that Representative Grunberg is probably correct on this. To me, effectiveness makes more sense than usability.
Well, I just going to make, each word has a separate meaning, whatever it is. And I'm not sure I know the difference between usability and effectiveness. I can think of some examples, maybe outside this bill, but what is the legal difference? Anybody know? Any of our attorneys on,
Mr. Chair,
in the universe know that?
Representative Lynn, it's not really it's a description, the reason Ernest works for me, I guess we think alike, because to me usability sounds better, but it doesn't, it's not a, we could go to Webster's maybe, but I don't know.
I like to think like using a tool, yeah. It could be useful, and, I've got a lousy can opener down here where I stay. It's usable, but the one I have at home in Anchorage is far more effective. Yeah. But they both are useful.
Yeah. Did you have something, Representative Foster? I'll remove my objection. I'll be easy on this. Okay, so the amendment to the amendment passes that we just talked about. That's the deletion of lines 13 through 15 on page 2 of the amendment number 10. Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ernest, I may have misunderstood. I thought what Ernest said, and my amendment will only relate to deleting line 18, which would leave the word dissemination in. So the phrase would be collection, and we'd have to take out the and before dissemination. Be collection, dissemination, and extrapolation. So with that, it's a conceptual amendment, and the amendment will be on line 19 of page 19. We will put a comma after collection, strike the word and, after dissemination, put a comma, and say and extrapolation. And they may decide to do it in a different order. That's up to the staff. And that's my amendment.
Any objection? None. Okay, amendment number, amendment to the amendment number 10 passes. This is number 2.
It's by the way, what is this whole amendment number?
This is amendment
10. Okay.
Representative Grunberg, did you have another
amendment? Yeah, I did. I just, it's number 10.
Okay.
Okay, yes, I did, Mr. Chair. Okay. My third thing, you know, I understand, yes. Okay, my third thing, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Is, and I'm not sure, okay, this is what I'd like to do. This deals with the amendment on page 2, lines 24 through 25, which deals with that whole little subsection B. Could we move that portion of it to the bottom of the pile? I want to talk to Ernest and Jordan about that and see if we can come up with something on Friday.
Representative Grunberg, I'm going to object to that. We want to act on this, and if you move to delete 24 and 25, I will object and be firm. But let me finish. Then if there's things that need to be added on, we can do that to the CS. In other words, you see, that solves both problems. In other words, as you read that then in the CS and something occurs to you that got missed, yeah, then we can add it on.
I'm not going to offer that. And the final thing, Mr. Chair, is on page 3 of the amendment, line 5. It should be, it's a grammatical change, changing the word in to the word of, so it would read, the sufficiency of resources to blah, blah, blah.
Great. No objection? Okay, that passes. Now, help me out. Who objected to amendment number 10?
I think I did, and I withdraw the
objection. Any other further objection? Amendment 10 passes. And believe it or not, that's the end of the pile for today.
Oh, no. Mr. Chair, there was something that we forgot.
Representative Grunberg, you have the floor.
Okay. I got in the pile yesterday, where do we put this stuff? Here it is. Okay. This was given to me but with the pile, and I looked at it, and I assumed it was going to be given out today. It deals with the very beginning of the bill, custodial interference, and there was another amendment we just, I think, overlooked.
Ernest, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, for record, Ernest Prox, there is, I think it's L9.
Right.
That one were mistaken. I did send it out as part of the packet electronically, but we just, I think it was today we made the decision not to offer that one. So I guess for right now, don't worry about it.
And if I remember right, it had to do with the use of the word intent, and it would have made the improving the intent of the parent that was picking up the child difficult, and so we decided it wasn't worth pursuing. That's kind of the heart of the thing. So I think it was just a good idea that just didn't come together. So,
Mr. Chair, I'll give notice that I may come up with something for Friday because I thought we were going to take it up.
Oh, okay. Okay, great.
I'm sorry.
I guess great. No, I'm kidding. We're going to do. I think we moved down the road here. We bolted something together. We got a CS now that we can deal with, and we have several pending amendments to those CSs and or the DCS. On Friday, what we're going to do is have a confirmation hearing for the Board of Governors, Alaska Bar, And then we have SB 187, which is child welfare confidential information. And then we'll get back to SB 64, and we'll follow the same pattern. We'll shoot for 2 o'clock start on SB 64. And, you know, if all goes well, maybe we can pass a whole bill out. Wouldn't that be something, huh? Senator, Representative Gruber.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I'm going to do my best on these several amendments I'm working on to try to get them in as soon as possible. Ted went home sick, so I can't work with him today. But as soon as he comes back, I'm going to be, and I'm happy to work with you guys.
And Representative Gruber, thank you for saying that, because as we proceed here, you know, if timing and things come up and this kind of thing, and we can't handle or we can't address something completely, that's to be expected. Again, the goal here is to judicially move this important bill.
Yeah.
So if we don't get to it, it isn't any reflection on Ted or anybody else. It's just, you know, hey, we got to press on at some point. So, yeah. Thank you. With that, we're adjourned at 3:45.